The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com.
It was a choppy response to the consumer price index as well as the retail sales number. Here to kind of have us shape our idea of how to view these two numbers is Peter Scheer, head of macro strategy at Academy Securities based in Connecticut. Peter, thank you so much for joining us. So the initial response was to sell stocks, sell bonds, gold, who knows? People just wringing their hands. What did you make of this? I mean, was this a good report given the CPI accelerating fast more than people expected? Or was it a bad report given the retail sales coming in an underwhelming way?
I think it is a bad report. I think this retail sales is very problematic. And when I look back at some of the recent data we had, I think it was the Richmond Fed, the New York Fed, a lot of the regional Feds have missed on their reports. I look at the Citi Economic Surprise Index, that's been turning down. So the one thing that's helped this market through all this volatility is this real belief that the fundamentals are okay. I'm wondering if this is going to call some of that into question.
So, Pete, what's the trade?
I think you continue to sell risk. We bounced off that low on Friday. We have an opportunity to take off some risk. I think you want to be careful here. It's still very volatile. It's still very uncertain what's going on. And if there is anything that starts to show weakness in the economy or some of the trade negotiations start turning bad, I think there's risk to more downside and going back to those lows.
Okay, so what risk do you sell? Do you sell riskier credit in the U.S.? Do you sell emerging markets? Do you sell stocks?
I think you sell a little bit of stocks here. I think emerging markets. I would not be selling high yield here, although people are selling that again today, only because I think that has become a very crowded short position. For some reason, people in the credit markets hate high yield. If you're a macro player, you hate high yield. Everyone's kind of fixated on high yield as a short, and it's very costly to short that right now. So I think there's better opportunities. So I'd be probably shorting some EM and more likely even some U.S. equities here.
So with emerging markets, how should people be trying to either go short emerging markets or should they just sell? Because I was looking this morning at spreads, extra yield over benchmarks on high-yield bonds in the U.S. versus high-yield bonds in emerging markets. And right now, you're getting no premium whatsoever for going into emerging markets high-yield bonds over U.S. high-yield bonds. How do people play that?
I think you could take a look at something like EMB, which is a emerging market bond ETF. It's not going to quite capture what you're looking at there, but I think close enough. And I think that's what people are going to start doing is they're going to look at high yield and say, wow, my high yield bonds are down 3 points or 4 points and my EM bonds only down 1 point. Maybe I should sell those. So I think that is a relative value transformation that tends to occur.
So, Peter, why are you not fixated on the consumer price index?
It's been so volatile. They have told us, you know, time and time again to focus on PCE anyways. It's one number, and if anything, if I really wanted to fixate on this, I'd start getting nervous that we're seeing some signs of stagflation, right? We're finally creating inflation without the underlying growth maybe there that needs to be. Again, it's premature to look at it like that, but I think we're going to start testing this whole economic fundamental is great theory in the next week or so in terms of data.
So what does this do for the Fed? I mean, right now the market's pricing in 100% chance of a March rate hike. Does this mean that they have more ammunition to increase rates faster because of some inflationary pressure? Or does that mean that they're going to hold back because there's sort of a questionable dynamic underlying the growth story?
Yeah, my view is that they will hike in March. I think that's still on the table, and you know the CPI lets them do that. But I think they will give us some cautionary tales that they want to watch what's going on with the consumer. You know, this is now not just this month's number was bad, but they revised down last month. You've seen an uptick in credit card delinquencies. You've also seen all these bizarre stories, to my mind, of people not being allowed to buy Bitcoin on their credit cards, which calls into question who was buying Bitcoin on credit cards. So I think they're going to be cautious and say, hey, we've risen rates a lot. Let's see what this does to the consumer.
Pete, what about stagflation? What would have to happen for you to make that a headline for you?
I think we'd need to really believe that inflation is here. And I just question that. And we're starting to see, you know, things like oil have rolled over a little bit. So a lot of the inflationary pressures that were there, I think will go down. We will see. Maybe there are going to be all these wage hikes related to tax reform, and that could help and really drive some pressure. But right now, we're just seeing more one-time bonuses rather than big wage increases.
And there's no inflation number that would get you to change your mind, let's say?
No, I think if this continues and is persistent, I would become concerned then that we've really created inflation. And hopefully if we've created that, these bad retail sales numbers will be an anomaly. So I guess I'm looking for probably another month or so that starts confirming or at least the sneaking suspicion that inflation has increased while growth is slowing.
All right. Well, we're going to check in with you then, of course. Peter Cheer is the head of macro strategy at Academy Securities. He's based in Connecticut, giving us his thoughts about inflation, but also really sparing no effort when he looks at those retail sales numbers. The future of infrastructure in the United States calls for experts to give us their thoughts, advice, and their experience. Walter Kempsies is the economist and chief strategist for U.S. Ports, Airports, and Global Infrastructure Group of JAL. That's Jones Lang LaSalle, and they're based in Chicago. Walter, thank you very much for being here. Maybe just tell people a little bit about your background and that you're currently advising the U.S. Department of Commerce, their advisory committee on supply chain competitiveness, as well as the Department of Transportation's task force on infrastructure evaluation. Maybe just give us a little bit of a hint of your background and how you're applying that to the president's effort to improve the infrastructure quality in the United States.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm a former investment banker who got pulled into a marine engineering firm, Moffitt and Nickel, to help the financial community as they were trying to initially invest in infrastructure about 12, 15 years ago. That role eventually morphed into planning the infrastructure, and I've worked with a number of port authorities around the country in strategic development plans, making sure they had the capacity in advance of the freight coming in. And as a result of that work, I was asked to join the Department of Commerce Advisory Committee on Supply Chain Competitiveness, which is comprised of port authorities, railroads, big importers and big exporters, as well as a few advisory experts like myself.
So, Walter, since you talk with U.S. ports and airports and other infrastructure groups, what's their outlook on how much money is going to get unleashed by some sort of infrastructure spending program? And what can we glean from the budget that President Trump put out earlier this week that most people said was dead on arrival? Is there anything, any details that we can hang on to?
Okay. I mean, just if you're just looking at the port sector on the water side of the ports, the American Association Port Authorities estimates about $66 billion, you know, to raise bridges, to dredge channels, to strengthen key walls, and buy bigger equipment to handle the bigger ships. What they don't have an estimate for is on the land side, because, you know, as the volumes have grown in this country, the economy, the population, the number of paved miles have not kept pace. And in the major port cities, we see a lot of congestion, such as in Los Angeles, Long Beach, as well as New York. You can add other cities to that, but that's the part where the estimated cost doesn't exist. But I would put that number at twice what we need for the water side. In terms of the plan itself, I think people need to understand that this is not supposed to be an Eisenhower interstate program. We've already built our interstate. We've built the core infrastructure. But this is supposed to be a means to repair and upgrade all of our infrastructure, including transportation, energy, and the water supply. And ever since the Eisenhower era, responsibility has shifted to states and local governments, to not only direct the infrastructure investments, but also as a means to reduce the incentives to use free federal money, and I say free in quotes, but free federal money to generate jobs building roads to nowhere. So the whole idea here is to target about $200 billion as seed capital, which along with other actions such as a shot clock on permit approval time will make it a lot easier for private capital to invest. The other part of the program also includes loosening the federal loan programs such as TIFIA, WIFIA, RIF, and the other, you know, alphabet soup of programs that exist that currently, are structured to help somebody, do the upfront capital expenditures, but be able to wait a number of years before generating the revenue necessary for debt repayment. The problem with these programs is they've been extremely stingy and loans generally don't get approved. So there is an effort to loosen that in order to unleash the federal support that's available already.
Walter, is there a project that you could use as a showcase, and I mean you as collectively, the industry, that could be used as a showcase in order to demonstrate both to politicians and to the electorate that these programs can work, that then would foster even greater incentive and desire to accomplish these things? Because it seems as though we don't have a specific objective, and that makes it even more challenging.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. One of the things that the program falls short on is to tie all of this effort into some kind of national economic objective. And the simplest one, and this relates to the efforts for free trade agreement renegotiations, is to support exports. You know, most of our infrastructure investment in the last 20, 30 years has gone towards the import side of the trade flows. And when you look at it, you know, volume-wise, the U.S. trade deficit is practically zero. But we import high-value per ton goods, and we export low-value per ton goods. So on a dollar basis, we run a very large trade deficit, averaging $500 billion a year for the last, 5-10 years. So the money would naturally be attracted to where there is a high value per ton. There's more pricing power in there, and there's more return available. If we tied the infrastructure program to something like supporting exports, then I think things would work a little bit better. And part of the problem is that as jobs have left the U.S., jobs in the export-oriented industries haven't taken up the slack in the labor markets. So if we do renegotiate the trade agreements and open the markets to U.S. exports, we will need to invest in infrastructure to support that.
So just to be really clear, what is that spending that needs to support exports?
Yeah. The first off, it would be on the Mississippi Waterway. Most of that was built in the 1930s, during the Great Depression. That infrastructure is now 75 years or older. The Soybean Transportation Coalition has done a report, a couple of them now, and they've pointed out that roughly 3/4 of our Mississippi Waterway infrastructure is over 75 years of age. And the way it works with the dams and the locks is that they're built with a 50-year life cycle. And every 25 years, you inspect it and try to retrofit it a little bit and get another 25 years out of it. But when you hit 75 years, that's it. You're done. You need to replace it, just like we're doing with the bridges in New York, perhaps a little late. But that Mississippi Waterway infrastructure, when it breaks down, when a lock breaks down, miles of barges back up on either side because they can't traverse the step in the river.
Yeah.
And oftentimes we have to 3D print the part because it just doesn't exist anymore.
Walter Kemsies, thank you so much for your insights. We'll have to have you back. Walter Kemsies, economist and chief strategist for U.S. Ports, Airports, and the Global Infrastructure Group at JLL Jones Lang LaSalle in Chicago, joining us by phone.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The shares of Marriott International, they're higher by a little bit more than 1% right now. The company will report results after the close of trading today, based in Bethesda, Maryland, home to Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2. And here to tell us about the company and more in the hospitality industry is Mike Belisario, equity analyst at Baird. Mike, what can you tell us about Marriott and I guess it's the year since they acquired the Starwood brand. What are they going to post in terms of savings and asset sales?
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me. I think you're going to hear a lot from Marriott that we heard from from Hilton this morning. Really strong fourth quarter guidance for 2018 that is pretty much in line with the results that they posted for full year 2017. I mean, specifically for Marriott, it's been 15, 16 months since they've closed the transaction. Investors are really focused on the synergies. A lot of those have been realized. Asset sales here or there, that's important. A lot of the heavy lifting's been done. I think the thing people are really focused on is all the extra benefit that Marriott being bigger, having more negotiating power, can pass to its owners, especially in a tough operating environment like today.
So, Mike, I'm wondering just about the tourism industry in general. We had heard reports, given some of the talk of the current presidential administration about foreigners and immigrants and all of that, that it would have a dampening effect on tourism. Did we see any of that from Hilton's results?
We did, and we've seen that broadly in the data. Inbound international travel to the U.S. Was down a bit in 2017. Hilton this morning thinks its inbound travel was down about 4%, but that only makes up, 5-ish percent of their total business. Some of that is the political backlash. If you're someone overseas and you might not want to come to the U.S. because you don't like what you're hearing, that's possible. Some of it is also the U.S. dollar. It was more expensive throughout 2017 to come to the U.S. And on the flip side, too, we don't talk about it enough, is the domestic traveler, the U.S. traveler, not going on vacation to Florida or Southern California, but because it's so cheap to go to Europe or Japan, for example, more U.S. citizens going abroad, too. So that's also an impact in the numbers that people don't talk a lot about. But yes, there was an impact in 2017. We're still seeing it on the inbound international travel side.
So of the big hospitality companies, which are most exposed to that trend of domestic tourists from the U.S. going international and not as many inbound tourists in the U.S.?
Actually, the biggest beneficiary on a percentage basis would be Hyatt, because a larger percent of their portfolio is overseas. Hilton, Marriott, and Hyatt, Hilton's the most domestic-focused. The way to think about it, too, is where do people come to the U.S.? They go to New York, they go to San Francisco, Los Angeles. So anyone that has urban market, gateway market exposure, if you're an owner of hotels in those markets, which a lot of the REITs are, those companies are also disproportionately impacted. But Marriott's brand, Hilton's brand in the U.S., overseas, if you can capture that same traveler that was maybe going to travel to the Marriott in Orlando, but they're going to the Marriott in Prague, that's kind of a win-win for Marriott in its eyes.
So does this mean that, Mike, that expansion for these growth markets in Asia and Europe, would that be key to achieving some of these profit targets?
Absolutely. Roughly half of the big brands' pipelines is outside of the United States. we kind of zoom out, these big global hotel companies, they're very focused in the U.S. and in North America. There's a lot of white space still in Europe, in Asia Pacific, and even in Africa. So a lot of the growth is coming from there. You're just also working off a smaller base. But yeah, that's where they're focusing a lot of their efforts to kind of capture both of the inbound and outbound travel, but particularly from China.
We've actually seen the dollar weaken this year a little bit. Does that matter, or in the scheme of things, is it such a minimal weakening that it's not going to change the trend that we saw in 2017?
It matters. That actually came up on Hilton's conference call. It's hard to tell on a week-to-week, month-to-month basis. I think over rolling 12-month periods, it's important. And on the margin, it does cause people to either say, yes or no, I want to go to the U.S., or yes or no, I want to go to London instead of Japan, for example. And there's also a lag to booking. If you're a leisure traveler, you're more price sensitive, and you're sometimes booking 3 to 6 months out. So if there is a weakening or strengthening of the dollar, you're not necessarily going to see it now. It might not be until June or July or August, for example, when we actually see the impact of what happened to the dollar today.
Mike Belisario, thank you so much for joining us. Really interesting insights. Mike Belisario is Senior Equity Research Analyst at Baird, coming to us from Chicago. The New York Fed put out a report this week taking a look at consumer debt, and it showed that student loan outstanding have totaled $1.4 trillion, and delinquencies could be up to 22% if you take out instances of students who are not required to make payments because they're still in school, unemployed, or for other reasons. Joining us now is Marshall Steinbaum, research director and fellow at the Roosevelt Institute in Washington, D.C. Marshall, thank you so much for joining us. This is a really important topic. I'm just wondering, you did a report looking at the macroeconomic implications of this rising pile of student debt. What are the implications? I mean, they could be quite significant, considering that this is now a $1.4 trillion pile of debt.
The effect on the macroeconomy of canceling all the outstanding student debt, and what we found is that it would have a moderate stimulative effect on overall output. I think the numbers $86 billion to $100 billion a year, approximately, given the two models that we used, that it would reduce the unemployment rate and increase the total rate of people being employed. And the main effect is because essentially the debt is burdening the balance sheets of households, especially young households. And if they didn't have to make those payments, they would spend the money on other things, and that would increase aggregate demand.
Where would the money come from in order to pay off this debt?
That's a good question. Currently, the federal government is the lender for about 90% of the debt. And what we modeled is essentially them for canceling it. So just writing it off, and then the other 10%, the federal government would assume making payments to the private lenders on behalf of students. So overall, both of those two things would increase the federal deficit and the federal debt outstanding while relieving debt from individual households. And the whole macroeconomic mechanism that's going on in the forecast of the effects is that transfer of the debt from households to the government is macroeconomically beneficial.
Okay, but if the government is going to be the one to foot the bill, doesn't that really mean that the taxpayer is the one to foot the bill?
Well, we've been running up debt and deficits for a long time now, and the tax share of total output is, I think, at its lowest ever, or lowest in a very long time, and low for the state of the business cycle where we currently are. Normally, you'd expect the federal government to be collecting the most in taxes when the economy is doing relatively well. So I think, you know, whether there's a tight connection between the federal government assuming debt and collecting taxes to pay that debt, I think that's an open question in macroeconomics.
I'm trying to figure out. So your report found that there would be this modest stimulative effect if the student debt were canceled of up to $108 billion per year. Does that change over time? I mean, how do you quantify the economic effect of student debt on a generation of people who might be delaying home purchases or having children or taking jobs that that are riskier but might have more potential?
That's a great question, and we don't really do that in the paper that is specifically look at questions of like homeownership or small business formation or what jobs do people take as a result of having debt. The macroeconomic models that we use to make those sort of big statements about how large the economy would be don't really get into that level of detail, but I think it's crucially important to understand what effect student debt is actually having on the economy. It's certainly true that now we have essentially a whole generation of workers who felt that they had to take on some level of student debt to get access to the labor market, much more so than was the case previously. And I think that given that the labor market has not been performing terribly well, that wages are stagnant, they feel that that debt is a burden rather than an opening to social mobility and to better jobs.
Well, how much of this is an indictment, frankly, on what individuals are paying for? In other words, some of the schools that aren't necessarily setting up students for jobs that are lucrative enough to make this debt seem relatively insignificant.
I think the overall explanation for why we have a student debt crisis in this country has to do with things that aren't really about higher education, although certainly part of the story is there. I think what happened was that we had a theory that the labor market was suffering from a skills gap and that the solution to that skills gap was to make sure that people had the education they needed for today's jobs. And ultimately, because that education would end up paying for itself in the form of higher wages, we got comfortable as a sort of policy priority of shifting the responsibility of paying for that education from state governments in the form of support for public higher education to individuals using the federal student loan program. And what we've found, I think, is that diagnosis of a skills gap was not correct. So people ended up paying for these degrees that were supposed to be the route to higher earnings. And it turned out that that really wasn't why wages were stagnating. The issue is not a skills gap, but rather trends in the economy that have to do with the power of employers and the ability of employers to essentially credentialize the labor market, so to demand a higher a level of credentials and thus a higher level of debt to go along with any given job.
Who has financially benefited from these student loans? I don't mean the students in trying to sort of connect it with a future employment, but who's benefited financially, and why don't they then, if the government or someone decides that this is something that we should not be supporting, why not have them assume the burden of this financial problem?
I mean, that's a very good question. I think so. Aside, you know, the federal government is the lender, so in a direct sense, they have benefited financially. I mean, this is, I think, a policy that the federal government decided to undertake, that they wanted more people to get degrees, and so they were willing to extend loans on what, for the private sector, would be considered pretty generous terms. In exchange for having more people get higher education. I think beyond that, you have a lot of institutions that have benefited a great deal from what I would consider a credentialization spiral. So they're able to sell degrees to people who wouldn't previously have needed those degrees in order to get access to the jobs they want. I think, you know, I think people tend to point to the for-profit higher education providers as being especially kind of culpable in that sense, but I think it doesn't just extend to them. And then the other piece of this is that the federal government, you know, really doesn't manage this large loan portfolio by itself. It has servicers. When the federal government took over responsibility as the lender, that has stopped guaranteeing private loans and started being the lender itself for newly originated loans, the financial institutions that had been the lenders before became servicers, and then there are some other bodies that service these loans, and they have an incentive to essentially extend payment as long as possible, and not necessarily to inform borrowers what their best options are about how to, for instance, avail themselves of public service loan forgiveness and other income-based repayment.
So it's, in other words, almost like a credit card situation where, you know, you sort of demonize the people for getting into debt, but you encourage them to be able to take out more debt by offering them all kinds of incentives to do so.
Yeah, and I think that is an apt point, because we have this sort of glow of higher education associated with student loans, and that's let people get, financial institutions and other stakeholders get away with tactics that I think there has been greater scrutiny of when the question is credit card loans or home mortgages. I mean, we had sort of the scrutiny that arose in the financial crisis to other forms of other parts of the credit market that I think student debt has largely avoided.
So which age group is most burdened by this $1.4 trillion?
Well, it's certainly younger workers are most burdened by it. You can see the enormous skyrocketing percentage of workers in the like 25 to 40 age cohort that have student loans relative to what that cohort would have had in earlier eras. Or I should say what that age group would have had in earlier eras. I should also say that a lot of families go into intergenerational debt. There are federal programs that explicitly encourage that, and then I think it's just natural that parents and grandparents and other family members want to contribute to their children getting educated and getting access to the labor market and to good jobs. And so there's a good report from the Federal Reserve Community Affairs Division that comes out every year that sort of goes into that, the story of student debt extending beyond the student and the debtor themselves.
Marshall, have you seen any change from employers of not demanding sort of an increase in credentials?
No, the opposite. I think it's going on and on. I think, you know, employers know that they can get more credentialed workers for essentially the same or lower wage as they did in the past.
And just briefly, have people conflated this current kind of student debt explosion with what were GI loans? In other words, saying they're kind of the same things? I beg your pardon. You know what? We're going to go to, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Marshall Steinbaum, Research Director, Fellow Roosevelt Institute in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.